with maniacal energy, like crazed bees, chaining and manacling every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic to work in the sugar fields of the Caribbean, of the tobacco fields of the Chesapeake area of the North American mainland.
Or the rice fields in the Carolinas, as was mentioned earlier on previous show. Well, I'm sorry I didn't get more of that on Gerald Horn. Again, you can find him on YouTube if you're looking. It's Horn with an E. The E is silent, as he jokingly says. But the Somerset case, I just want to do a little, I'm a minute past already, and labor hour is coming up, but Somerset case was a case of an escaped slave who was in England who sued to not be sent back as property. And it sobered the colonists a lot that the Crown basically said he was a person and wasn't property and wouldn't be returned, flying in the face of all of the fugitive slave laws, et cetera, that were ensconced. So American history from another point of view, that's for sure. Opinions of those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station, part in toto. It's 2 minutes after the hour. Labor hour is on an informal summer schedule, they say. So I hope they get their forbearance. And thanks for listening. And again, Gerald Horn at University of Houston. Well-tenured position, I trust. We'll be right back.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you in the air by listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. The views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners to WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And I'd like to wish Angela a happy birthday. Angela, glad to, you're here with us today, and want to wish you a happy birthday, a baby born on the 4th of July.
Thank
you.
Happy birthday, yes. Thank you.
And so,
booyah.
Okay. So we're going to do some news stories, and then we're going to kind of turn over to Angela, since it's this is kind of her birthday show, so she's got some topics she'd like to discuss, and we're going to open up the phone lines too, in case, you know, we talk about some of these topics that Angela's going to, you know, bring up. If you want to comment a little bit, you can call in. So first we'll go to Gus.
Yes, big week, of course. Everybody knows the jobs report was released finally. Again, we have some posturing by the U.S. government and by these fake conservative polls that are showing that we're doing so much economic recovery. The latest U.S. jobs report, which was released on Thursday by the Labor Department, has been greeted as another sign of this economic recovery. Speaking in La Crosse, Wisconsin, President Obama praised the June's jobs report as pointing to a record streak of private sector job growth. And on paper, it looks good. 223,000 jobs over the at this month, while the unemployment rate fell by 0.2 percentage points to 5.3%. Looks good on paper, and that's what they're feeding the masses right now. But any serious look at the latest figures reveals why Jim Clifton, who is head of the Gallup polling agency, has denounced the official unemployment rate as a big lie that largely ignores the continued prevalence of mass unemployment in the United States. And what we're talking about is labor participation by the public. The share of the U.S. population that is either employed or actively trying to find work, known as the labor force participation rate, has fallen to its lowest level in 38 years.
Wow.
The last time the figure was below its present level of 62.6% was in 1977, and that's before tens of millions of women entered the labor force. So the U.S. labor force participation rate for men, meanwhile, last month hit its lowest level ever on records dating back nearly seven decades.
Wow.
In 1948, 86% of men of working age were engaged in the labor force. Now, that figure is down to 69%. A decline of 17 percentage points. So this is the lowest labor participation rate we've had for males since World War II, since the end of World War II.
And also, you're the historian here, Gus. The 1948, that was only 3 years, two and a half probably, after the Second World War. So there was a lot of returning American soldiers, and there wasn't that many jobs probably initially, and there was a transition. And I don't think it really was until 1950 when the Korean War began that the U.S. economy started picking up, because there was all sorts of post-war strikes and other industrial actions at that time.
It was huge, too. And everybody knows that war is the biggest money maker, is the biggest capitalist monster in history.
Yes.
And so, of course, when the Korean War started, like you said, there was a big pickup and surge, especially with the increased suburbanization, mm-hmm. the highway acts, all these different things that were going on. They were creating these massive influx of jobs. Back in 1948, though, like you said, it was a very small market at that point after the war ended. So, of course, we're going to go back to war, and we had this thing called the Cold War, where we're invading other people's countries, trying to knock off communism and other things like that. The United States
government,
the U.S. government. So yeah, exactly like you said.
Yeah, and those countries they called communists were really actually just people who elected populist leaders that wanted to help the poor and the average working person.
Pretty much, and that's exactly what they were doing. But of course,
and what they're doing today,
exactly. But of course, in the United States sense, though, that's not feeding the 1%, the ruling class, so that has to go. You're messing up our capitalism.
Yep. Okay, just a couple of quick notes statewide here. Governor Rauner vetoed House Bill 4166 last week because the construction workers on the projects would be paid prevailing wage. Oh, how horrible. We encourage you to contact your state legislators and the governor's office to demand fair wages on Illinois taxpayer-funded projects. Mm. And to kind of back with that, along with that, the General Assembly in Illinois continues their work to pass a state budget and resist the demands of Governor Rauner. The Democratic members of the General Assembly are working hard to hold the line on the governor's unreasonable demands. His so-called compromises would destroy the middle class in Illinois. As we move into this holiday weekend, while you're enjoying your backyard barbecues, parades, and fireworks, if you happen to see a member of your General Assembly, like Carol might come to one of my barbecues, but I don't know anyone else.
She's always around.
But please thank them for standing with you and our and working families in Illinois. But the pressure is mounting. This is a disturbing thing. The pressure is mounting in Springfield to make sacrifices to the governor, even amongst the Democrats. And we need to take every opportunity to thank those Democrats who are supporting working families. And even though it doesn't say this from Michael Kerrigan, the only FSCL, I would add, and to condemn and threaten those Democrats that are going to fold.
I mean, but what we've been seeing actually since Rauner came in, we've actually been seeing a lot of fight from Springfield coming in.
That's like, true.
With Carol Ammons, and then some of the mm-hmm. even some of the Republicans are actually they're standing up and saying, you know what, we don't really agree with these things that are mm-hmm. going on. So not only do we have these Democrats coming in and putting their feet firmly in the ground, but we also have some Republicans that are standing up as well. So, I mean, it's just the fact that Rauner has taken such an extremist measure that he's pissed. He's made so many different people upset. I mean, these are things that we really have to consider while we stay on the ground fighting and trying to build these kind of coalitions from our grassroots organizations and identifying who we can use in Springfield to keep this fight going. Because
I heard that his extremist agenda has even made some Republican mayors of some small cities and villages mad because they're cutting off state funding of different types. He's also making hunters and fishermen mad because of cutbacks on Illinois Department of Natural Resources as far as stocking for fish and other things. So it's like, sometimes I feel like giving enough rope, he might hang himself. But on the other hand, I'm worried that he just keeps pushing. He's in determinated push that he's going to basically a lot of the Democrats going to say, well, let's just give him a little bit of what he wants, and then we're going to be another step back.
I hope
that doesn't happen, but I'm just saying that's kind of my concern.
I can see that being possibly a problem, but I think that because it's so extreme, if he was more so in the line of Scott Walker, remember when Scott Walker first came in, he wasn't as extreme. His stuff then start getting pushed out till later on. The day Rauner stepped in office, he let people know, I'm cutting everything. I'm going to be a proto-Reagan. I'm going to go beyond Reagan. I'm just going to destroy anything that helps anybody have some type of service or life.
From the public sector.
Exactly, in the public sector.
Yeah.
And so that's what I think. I'm thinking that he's already overreached his hand that they won't give him any leeway. And we've been seeing it in a lot of statements and a lot of things happening in Springfield at this point.
Good. I hope you're right, Gus.
I hope so too. Okay. I'm just going off a historical basis.
Sure, good. So what else do you have?
Well, this is interesting coming out of Ferguson. We haven't had a lot of news coming out of Ferguson recently, but there's been some investigations into the police department again there. And what we found out is that on Monday, the U.S. Justice Department, they finally woke up and decided to release a report detailing the official police response to the protest last year in Ferguson. And they found that the police actually provoked unrest in Ferguson. So what happened was is that just to give you the actual breakdown.
Yeah.
The limited rioting and looting, because it was limited, mm-hmm. although that's all you saw all over CNN and all the newspapers, was that they were looting and rioting, even though it was extremely limited and it was an organized mechanism, universally denounced and vilified in the corporate media, was in fact incited by the police. So all of the things that happened in terms of the looting and rioting, burning, this was actually, a lot of it was due to the fact that the police were causing these people to create these types of ideas to do these things. It wasn't something where it was just a spontaneous outburst, which is what they want you to think, that black folks just went around and just started burning things and looting things. It was an actual response.
Yes.
Meaning that it was a political movement, like I talked about a couple weeks ago with the Charleston incident, and that you cannot depoliticize what's been happening in America in terms of the race relations. This was a political movement. So here's what, here just to give you a small summary, the summary of the report states, had law enforcement released information on the officer involved shooting in a timely manner and continued the information flow as it became available, community distrust and media skepticism would most likely have been lessened. And the report documents the 16 days following the August 9, 2014 shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson, and the highly elevated tactical response on the part of 50 different police departments.
Yeah, all coming like they were just out of Baghdad or something.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Yeah. Like armored vehicles, yeah. Even military camouflage.
Oh, yeah. They were fully geared up like they were actually going into World War III.
Yeah.
I mean, to see that in a Missouri suburb.
Yes.
Like, how do you even have these mechanisms available to do that thing, to do these things in that small area?
Indeed.
But, yeah, so.
And we also know, too, that there's been cases of where the police have actually had infiltrators go in and break windows and stuff to justify them using violence against peaceful protesters.
Oh, of course.
I mean, there's documented cases of this, you know. It's not conspiracy theory. There's documented cases of this.
Exactly. They've actually admitted it, but of course, a lot of those records are hard to get, and you have the unions, like the Fraternal Order of Police, that are going around protecting these people, you know, coming up with all these legal measures to stop them from doing
things. Where is Darren Wilson these days?
Good question. Where is Darren Wilson?
Probably out in Idaho somewhere, maybe hiding out. He's probably a local constable or sheriff somewhere in some small little town.
They probably gave him a job, and he's probably making double what he made in Ferguson now to kind of lay low and
instead of being in jail. So, yeah. Angela, anything happened this week that's of interest to you?
No, I was just thinking about with the guy, the shooting in Charleston.
Oh, yes.
How they said that they took him to Burger King.
What?
He hadn't eaten in 2 days. Maybe that's what made him kill the people. Huh?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, they took him to Burger King. Who does that? Yeah.
I did. You know, that's why I don't watch the corporate media, but I'm glad other people do.
Saying, like, you know, they're rewarding white supremacy again. Like I said, this we're 100 years back to where after you would lynch someone, you would have a barbecue afterwards while their bodies were hanging. I'm serious. Like they would cook food. They would take pictures. They would play baseball right there in the field. I mean, this is we are regressing.
And you know, as I was on the Aaron Ammons show briefly, the last part of his show, and he was talking to a professor, an African American woman professor from South Carolina, and she was. I asked her the question. You know, how do you think that this recent wave of police murders, and I'm going to call them murders because anytime somebody kills an unarmed person, it's murder. And, you know, you debate me on that. I'm telling you, no human being has a right to kill another human being unless it's in self-defense of yourself or your family, you know. Mm-hmm. And do you think that this recent huge exponential increase in the last few years of police murders, in particular in the black community of unarmed people, has kind of encouraged some, you know, crazies like this guy. And she thinks it does. And I asked her, too, do you think the ruling class in this country are at least tolerating this sort of thing? And she brought in the point about the whole prison industrial complex, and she thought I had a good point. You know, I thought she was going to say, you know, kind of be, I was just trying to challenge her a little bit. I want to be a little provocative. And no, she thinks that this is what the ruling class wants to some degree.
And that's the thing.
Divide and conquer, you know.
Divide and conquer. And that's the thing, too. The people who the academics, the heads of labor organizations, the head of activist groups, they know these things are happening. Even though the NAACP doesn't directly address these types of issues like they do, they usually use legalism and the court system. They understand what you and I, what everybody else talks about, and that this is something that is deeply entrenched in the society. And the only way to look at it is to tie all these different strands together. The prison industrial complex, the drug war, police violence, white supremacy, economic stratification, neoliberalism and capitalism, things like that. I mean, you have to tie these things together. It's a very complex and complicated system.
You know, when I was gone for a couple of weeks, a little vacation with my family, I took along a Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States and didn't have much time. I got basically the first 50 pages where he's talking about colonial America. And I mean, this country started, originally explorers, so to speak, but it was part of basically a corporate company in basically the West India Company to look for new markets. And then when they got here, they didn't have the labor force to do it. So that's when they decided to bring in African slaves and Irish indentured servants, which are slaves, contractual slaves. And they were talking about how the constant fear of the ruling class was, because it happened all the time, where African slaves and Irish indentured servants would revolt together. They would run off together. They would even, have personal relationships together. And that was their biggest fear, is that there would be a united uprising amongst, because it was like, the ruling class, those plantation class, was a very small minority, the population. And so that's when they started the segregation laws, is to separate, and then on top of that, to maybe give, the European working people and indentured servants just a little more privilege than the African, slaves. And at the same time saying, you're better than them because you're the same color we are. And then at the same time, impose these real strict rules, severe rules, beatings, whippings, jail, even execution, if you violated these segregation laws, if you're white and you violated them, or if you're black and you violated them, So the more I hear about this, the more I keep, I was reading it, I'm thinking, gosh, how much, it seems so similar to kind of what's going on today. A plantation system, it's just a little more sophisticated,
Yeah, you can kind of take it further than that, actually. You can talk about And if anybody wants to get this book, Peter Wood's Black Majority is one of the best examples of talking about what Dave is talking about, is that the small group of plantation owners, the small minority, the 2% of this country at that time, they were deeply, deeply, deeply afraid of worker solidarity between whites and blacks in this country. That's why they created this thing called race and racism, racial oppression, which is fiction, but they created it to keep the workers divided. And what's happening is, the book goes through so many different examples, especially after the Haitian Revolution and a lot of Haitian refugees were starting to come to America. They were literally in emergency mode, especially in places like South Carolina and North Carolina. What if they get the ideas from them? Because they were spreading newspapers. People were talking about Toussaint L'Ouverture in the plantations. It was a huge thing. So they were coming up with all these different ideas and things. They actually tried to, in South Carolina, ship more indentured servants from Europe to kind of outweigh the black majority at that time, because there were so many black people that were there. So it really got scared, oh my God, there's a black majority, they're going to take us over. So the book really talks about a lot of different aspects of how the black majority were rebelling, and how the white plantation owners and the ruling class were coming up with all these different laws and regulations. And we go so far as talk about property rights, we're talking about mobility, even before the violence and stuff, just simple basic things to keep them inferior. It's a really fascinating, complex look, and we look at the things that are happening today.
And of course, the great book you recommended to me, which I'm still reading, W.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction in America, which is it's a labor history, really. As well as about Reconstruction.
It's the greatest book.
About how they were able to manipulate, African work, slaves and freedmen, African freedmen, and, European, they had this whole system to where if you're white and you don't go along with the system, you're going to find yourself and your family living out in the wilderness. And they would say, well, we can't give you a job on the plantation because we've got all these slaves doing that work, carpenter, whatever.
What that does is that creates antagonism amongst the workers.
And stuff.
That's why I say that book is the foundation of American history. There is no greater book to discuss, to talk about the original reasons and the foundations of history in this country.
Yes.
And I really believe that.
Yeah, that's a great book.
If you have a chance to get it, please go get it and read it.
Okay, one last little news story here. For me, and then if Gus has something else too, I guess the American Federation of Government Employees Union, which represents 670,000 federal workers, came out with an official statement condemning the cowardly acts of terrorism in South Carolina. And they quoted as saying, "We are appalled at the spate of fires at predominantly black churches across the South that has occurred in the weeks following the tragic shooting at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina. And that, anyway, they're saying, as leaders in the labor movement, we stand in solidarity with disadvantaged people everywhere who are fighting for equality, justice, and dignity at work, at home, and in their communities. These fights rarely are won without claiming victims along the way, but make no mistake, these cowardly acts of violence would not deter us and others from continuing the fight for equal rights for all people. In fact, our resolve is only strengthened. And, you know, it's a typical kind of, you know, statement. But I mean, at least they did something. You know, I don't know how many other unions came out and made a statement on this.
Exactly. And that's what, and I really appreciate that too, because that's one of the things I always criticize, is that the unions have to really become more active and be more assertive. In fact, I would argue that every time anything happens, they should put statements out and mail them to their yes. membership. I mean, no matter what. I mean, it's at the point now where if you continue to consistently educate them, because there's so much crap going on today about how they are really trying to gut the working class. Mm-hmm. I mean, by mailing that stuff out every day and talking to the membership as much as possible, you're going to keep a consistent anger, a fervor in your people. Mm-hmm. And they're going to form that into an objective, and that will lead to a social movement. Indeed. I mean, that's the way you do things.
Yes.
So that's one of my biggest criticisms. Yep. And that's why last week when we talked about the guy, Dennis, I think his name is Dennis Williams.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember his name. We've had so many news stories. But the Dennis Williams, who was actually the leader of the United Auto Workers, and they're going through negotiations right now, and he basically is throwing his membership under the bus right now. I mean,
sad.
He's doing that.
Yes.
And they need to call him out. They need to issue absolutely. A statement.
And there's been rank and file movements in the UAW now for 30 years that's yeah. trying to, but it's just, you know, they get crushed and, you know, it's just like, that's a whole topic for a program.
Oh, yeah.
But I just want to say that I really liked, I was really impressed too, about your union, the Graduate Employees Union here in Urbana-Champaign, also coming out with a great statement, you know, about this whole thing. This, I'm going to call it what it is. It's a terrorist attack. It's domestic
exactly
terrorism, you know.
It was a political. It was a politically motivated terrorist attack, based on. I mean, yeah, we. Woo.
Yes.
Let me just do a
yes,
couple
one more story. Uh-huh.
Just a quick couple of stories. I'm just gonna quick shoot them. The first
okay.
one is that top bankers in 2014, the top 15 banks in this country, the CEOs, their pay all rose 17%.
Whoa.
Yes.
Man, couldn't we all use a 70% pay increase, huh?
Yeah,
they quibble when we want three.
The so-called socialist president of France, Francois Hollande.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. This guy, like I said, I knew it. What was going to happen whenever these people get in these positions in the system, they start co-opting. Mm-hmm. He has rejected suggestions to house Julian Assange to grant asylum to him. And he didn't even issue any reasons behind it. He just said, I'm just not going to do it, because it's going to mess up his new capitalist mindset now.
Yeah.
This makes me sick how these people just co-opt themselves.
Yeah, and we have a huge gratitude to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for releasing all these documents mm-hmm. that the ruling class in this country and in other countries wanted to keep secret, you know.
Exactly.
And, you know, they definitely want to get him.
Yes.
I mean, man, he's been how long has he been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London? Does it 4 years?
Yeah, I think that happened back in 2010.
God, it's been over 4 years he's been in there. You know, basically can't leave. You know, they'll arrest him and extradite him to Sweden. And of course, we know what's going to happen. As soon as he gets to Sweden, he'll be extradited to the United States, and he'll be facing capital, probably charges of
treason.
Well, he's not a U.S. citizen, so but espionage.
Oh, espionage.
You know,
yeah.
And he could receive the death penalty for basically informing the world about, you know, the illegal and immoral activities that the U.S. government and some other governments around the world have been doing. You know, he's a hero. He's not a traitor. Or
who were the last two that were put to death for that particular cause? Julius and Edward Rosenberg.
Yeah,
they're trying to bring it back.
Yeah, indeed. So we're going to take a quick. Do you have anything else?
Real quick? No,
we're going to take a quick music break and we'll be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WFT in Champaign. Stay tuned.
I call it hush money. Because when the big banks got the bailout, they didn't help the American people. CEOs got big bonuses to keep their dirty little secret. So basically, they got paid to blow up the economic system.
It's the biggest Ponzi, more than $7 trillion. Charged back to the working civilian. We foot the bill when they roll them dice. Why they use our money to control our life? You ain't gotta dumb it down, just smarten up. If we don't, they'll continue to target us. They couldn't come up with a fall guy. They had to decide how to keep everybody all quiet. That's what's next.
They cut checks, compensation, gag orders, nuff said. Lehman Brothers, before collapse, 183 million fell in they laps. Goldman Sachs received a waiver and an $814 billion disclaimer. Douglas Morgan, the Citibank chief, need $21 billion to turn the upper cheek and get his hush money. Hush money, hush money. They call it bailout, we call it hush money. Hush money, hush money. Hush money, hush money. Send them to the jailhouse, corrupt money. Hush money, hush money. Hush money, hush money. They call it bailout, we call it hush money. Hush money, hush money. Hush money, hush money. Send them to the jailhouse, corrupt money. The list goes on. Marshall and Osley, $21 billion, don't speak what your eyes see. No evil. Jeffrey Amell got $16 billion just to keep to himself. And James M. Wells scored 7.5, just like L. Philip Newman, to bury more lies.
Okay, that was a hip-hop band out of Boston called Twice Thou, and that song was called Hush Money, you know. And great band. I mean, you know what? There's not a single word of profanity in any of their music, and all their music has some great, you know, political, social, you know, themes to them and everything. So some quick public service announcements here. There are two kinds of people who want to cut Social Security: liars and people who believe the lies. They heard the right-wing talking points. Social Security is going to be broke. Social Security won't be there for me when I retire. The only way to save Social Security is to cut benefits. Unfortunately, these Wall Street-funded lies have gotten plenty of traction in recent years, so much so that a recent survey shows that 43% of young people under 30 believe that Social Security won't be there for when they retire, but this is a total lie. Social Security has a $2.8 trillion surplus and can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible person for the nearly two decades. Social Security has not contributed one penny to the deficit because it's independently funded by the FICA payroll tax. Proposed tweaks to Social Security would hurt seniors, disabled veterans, and people with disabilities. And we all need to start asking millionaires and billionaires to start paying into Social Security at the same rate as the rest of us. Because if you make over, I think, what is it, Gus, $170,000 a year, you don't pay a penny into Social Security. Yep. You know, and that's just not right, and that's not how other countries do their Social Security system. So call your congressman, U.S. Congressman Senator Day, and tell them, hands off Social Security, and that instead expand both Social Security and Medicare to help your average American out there. And also, I want to mention too, real quick here, that tune in on every Tuesday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WRFU 104.5, our sister station over in Urbana, the Independent Media Center, for Changing the Game with hosts Martel Miller and Chris Evans. And also tune in this Sunday on Urbana Public Television's for Labor's Worldview TV, and that's every Sunday 4 to 5. And this Sunday, the great movie called Why We Fight, which is a great film documenting the whole military-industrial complex in this country, and how the corporate media and the, you know, people who basically get rich off of wars, basically how it formed, how it's continuing today, how they manipulate us, and really important. It's really interesting. The film starts out with President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address to Congress, saying, "Beware of the military-industrial complex," and that was in January of 1960, and that was quite telling. So anything going on in the community, Gus or Angela, that you'd like the listeners to hear about, besides the parade today that's, I guess, already started?
Oh yeah, they did start today.
Anything going on in the community, huh?
Okay, that might be a good segue to you. Okay, so Angela, what's going on in the community? What's been happening in your life? What do you think's happening in the world? I mean, just this is your program today. And again, happy birthday. I want to open up phone lines for callers that'd like to call in. So take it away.
Sure. Well, I'm going to say I'm glad to be here today. It's always good to turn another year, you know. You get older, you get wiser, hopefully. Some people don't.
Yeah.
But I know as far as power bills go, there's a PIPS program, and it's benefiting a lot of people, but just so happens it just got cut off. Look, they just called me yesterday, and they said, your appointment is canceled. So I'm like, okay, and why? They don't have any money. I think they said they're $4 billion in the hole or something like that.
Wow.
But people were looking forward to that, so now I have to limit my air conditioning. But, you know, other than that, pretty much.
Well, then let's talk about winter coming up. I mean, that's a scary thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, people can live without air conditioning, even though it can be miserable. And it can be dangerous, though, especially for elderly people in the extreme heat. So, you know, but winter, Man, I mean, the thought of that. I mean, and it's like there's no money for it. Come on. Come on. There's plenty of money out there.
Yeah.
There's plenty of money out there.
What's happening? On a lot of stuff that we don't need.
What's happening is the profit. The profit was not what they want. What yes. They wanted.
Okay, let's see what the caller has to say. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Jim Iman checking in.
Hello, Jim.
I got a real kick out of the fact that Barack Obama sang Amazing Grace. Most people know that it's the lynching anthem of the Old South.
Really? Amazing Grace was the lynching anthem of the Old South?
Of course.
Absolutely. Yeah. No self-respecting lynch mob would always sing Amazing Grace.
I thought it was a song written by some British English abolitionist who used to be a slave trader.
Well, he wasn't an abolitionist at all. He was a slaver.
Yeah.
His name was Nelson, and he created the song to sing to his six slaves that were being kicked overboard. After all, you can't ruin the cargo.
Oh, wow.
And contaminate the other slaves.
Mm-mm-mm.
And so it has been it was always sang to the victim, never for the people singing it.
Wow.
And that even comes up in Amistad.
Oh, yes, Amistad. Yeah, that's a great film. Yeah. Yeah.
And we haven't had a governor in jail for a long time.
Yeah, governor going to jail. I mean, Illinois has kind of got a tradition of that. And you go down south, they go, oh, you're from Illinois, where all the crooks are. I go, well, at least we catch our crooks and put them in jail, like yours, you know. But you think there's grounds for putting Rauner in jail?
I remember the incident with Blagojevich when he appeared at the strike of Allied Windows and Doors. And after that appearance, within 24 hours, he was in jail.
Yeah. No coincidence there, I don't think.
And the one thing I have to say about Blagojevich is he did get kid care through.
Indeed. That's one thing that he did do. So anyway.
What we should do here mm-hmm. is actually get our hacker friends in Anonymous to get some dirt on Rauner. He's got to be dirty.
Yes.
You've got to find something.
I agree. Okay, Jim, thank you for calling in. Okay, yes, he thinks that he's hoping that maybe hackivist organization, Anonymous, should try to dig up some dirt on Rauner, you know, find something to put him in jail with, you know. But
At this point, I think he's probably going to put himself in jail.
Let's hope so.
The stuff he's doing, man, they might literally get him.
Yeah. So tell me about the PIPS. What is it again? Can you spell the acronym?
PIPS. P-I-P-P-S.
P-I-P-P-S. Yes. Okay. How long has that been around? Quite a while.
It's been around for a long time. I mm-hmm. just recently got on it. Two years ago.
Get funding problems. Right. Yeah.
But I mean, long as you paid it every month on time, you never had to worry about a disconnect notice mm-hmm. or anything.
Okay.
You stayed up on it, but you know they just called me and canceled my appointment. I had an appointment on July 14th. I'm like, okay, $64 a month. Can't beat that for a pound.
Yeah. So do you know of anybody that's going to try to fight back on this? I mean, you know other people that are on PIPS? Or?
Actually, I haven't heard anybody else talking about it. Mm-hmm. So,
it's got to be a lot of people affected by this.
I'm sure.
You know, that's the problem always is like if you could just find all those people out there who benefit from the PIPS program and, you know, get them organized and, you know, do something. Go out there and, you know, find out who's responsible for this and, you know, shut them down, you know.
Right.
Create some noise, you know.
I feel that maybe they should keep it on for the older people,
you know,
that are disabled or whatever. But
they should keep it on, period. Because they obviously had the money. And like I said before, what happened was is that their profit margin was 0.00% less than what they thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
So they want to make these cuts now and shut things off for people.
And talking about, what would you say, $4 billion in the hole? Come on.
That's what the paper said.
Come on. Are they really that bad at managing their money? I mean, all of a sudden, oops.
Exactly.
You know?
they're financial experts for a reason. They understand how to manage money and how to do things.
And manipulate you know, figures and facts. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, they're saying that you can get help in maybe September. They should have more.
Maybe
clients.
In September. Yeah, maybe.
What is 3 months going to do for so-called $4 billion?
Do you remember, I think it was about 10 years ago up in Chicago, we had a huge heat wave, and there was a lot of elderly people that died.
Yep.
I remember, you know, because they were a lot of those older brick buildings in Chicago, mm-hmm. and they didn't have any neighbors or family that checked in on them, you know, and everything. And they'd find, I mean, I think it was like, it had to have been at least a dozen or more elderly people that died from the heat, you know. So I'm saying it's dangerous, too, in the summertime when we get the heats that we do, you know. Yeah. So what else is new? It's hard to say. I'm sorry to hear about that. Yeah. And I just wish there's some way, you know, we could get organized on that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, other than that, my cousin is still in the hospital.
Oh, she? And still in a coma?
Still the same. Mm-hmm. No changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's like, wow. I asked people, I'm like, what's, forget all the mumbo jumbo, what's wrong? What's really going on? Just tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
She has a global brain damage.
Global?
Yes.
Okay.
Wow.
And, wow.
So what's going to happen now? I mean, is this...
Pretty much, they're saying that it's non-reversible, and there's nothing they can do about it. So, by the grace of God, only, you know, he can make the impossible possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is a mistake that they made. So,
oh, yes.
We don't know. You know, it could go either way, but, you know, it's just sad. And she's only 32 years old.
Oh, man.
Didn't even get to enjoy.
Did she have any children?
No.
Okay. I mean... That would have been really, really rough if that was the case,
yeah,
you know.
Definitely. But you know what? Mm. She is an only child of my aunt and uncle.
Oh, no. So she has no real immediate family or anything. Oh, gosh. Well, I'm hoping there's some kind of lawsuit pursued on this. I mean, at the very least, they need to put her in a quality care place, you know, nursing home, until she's recovered, and also pay for possible,
everything,
you know, advanced treatments to try to, you know, reverse this, you know. And so I don't know, you probably can't talk about it, but has there been at least talk about doing that? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, so what, you know, in the last week or so, I mean, what have you noticed been happening? You know, like anything caught your interest here in Champaign-Urbana or state or nationally? I mean, you know, kind of what's going on?
No, I was talking to my son, and one thing that I was looking at was that they had this factory or whatever where they make robots. Well, they have these robots, and a robot killed one of the employees.
Was this up in Rantoul?
I don't remember the exact place, but a robot killed a person. I'm like, oh my goodness.
In a factory? This is like a factory assembly robot. Okay.
Yeah.
And that happened, this here in Illinois, or?
This I don't know. I don't know exactly, but it just caught my eye. We were talking about
And
how can a robot, but you know what, though? This place, you know, I said, people better get on their jobs these days and go ahead and do what it is that you need to do, because if you don't have any money coming up in these next years, you're going to be still on the ground. You know we're going to be flying around like the Jetsons, right?
1% of us is going to be
1% of us will be flying around like the Jetsons.
Flying around with cameras and drone planes and all this, just watching us down on the ground.
Yeah.
That's exactly what they're going to do.
And down here, it's going to be like that film Mad Max, Beyond the Thunderdome.
Yeah, Thunderdome, yes.
But, you know, is this your other son that was telling you this?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
My youngest.
Okay, how's your other son doing?
He's ready to get out.
Okay.
He's, you know, nobody's happy and incarcerated.
I can't imagine.
But you know what? Let me tell you, I called the public defender last week, and I said, well, you know, how long is he going to have to do? He said that he'll be out in, next year, rather.
Mm-hmm.
But he was like, he said, your child has 8 felonies. Okay, well, no, he doesn't. You know what? They don't have their information right. So his father has been incarcerated 3 or 4 times, so they're getting him mixed up with his dad.
Same name, I take it?
Yes, same name. Mm. He said, well, your son has 8 felonies. No, he does not. Oh, okay, well, it's still a class 2 felony. Okay. Yeah, I feel like if it's under $4, that should not be a felony.
$4 and quarters.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Because I told him, I said, okay, well, the girl that was with him, she's out. The guy that was with him, he's out. He took it to trial, and he said that they told him they didn't have enough evidence. Okay, well, if you guys didn't have any evidence, then why is my son in jail?
That's a good point.
So that he can work and make money for the privateers. We got a new worker now.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. It's like our mutual friend. I mean he did quite he did 10 years in prison, and that's what he did. He sold clothing for the U.S. military, mm-hmm. and it was all piecework. Yep. You know, it was like the piece rate rates were like something you'd think that would be happening in Honduras or, yeah. I mean, someplace like that. So that's their solution: export jobs. And what jobs you have here, bring in and exploit undocumented people, workers from other countries that are just starving or facing political oppression, and bring back Michelle Alexander, the new Jim Crow, basically.
The convict lease system.
Yep, the new form of slavery, prison labor, dirt cheap, sweatshop, third world sweatshop pay.
You can't beat it. I mean, for the capitalists, I think that when Michael Vick was in, he said he was only making like 40 to 50 cents an hour or something.
Yeah.
And that was, and like working constantly, and that's all the pay they get. And then some of that, even whatever you get, you're spending at, to get like things for your sale. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's unbelievable the amount of production they put into their work versus mm-hmm. how much profit those items make for the privateers.
Yeah, and I'm sure the prisons are getting some kind of kickback, just like the whole phone thing. Have you had any experiences with talking to your son on the phone about the outrageous charges?
Oh, yeah, all the time. And, it's like, okay, if I want to send $20, the cost is $26. So pretty much... You still got to come up with that extra, and then there's a limit of you have to at least put $25 on the phone. That's the least you can pay. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they're taxed, and they are getting rich.
Mm-hmm.
These people
mm-hmm.
are rich.
Of other people's misery, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Masterminds.
I like that. I like
evil masterminds.
What they call supreme thuggery.
Yeah, supreme thuggery.
That's all they're like. Those thugs are out there rioting and looting in Baltimore. No. Supreme thuggery.
Yeah.
Is this stuff going on above our levels at the capitalist ruling class level?
And I know a lot of people aren't supposed to use the word thug anymore, but I do still use the word thug because I think for some people it's appropriate. And I think just what you said, Gus, it's the people who cause the suffering for the majority of people in this country. They're the thugs.
Yeah, whenever I get a story.
That word is appropriate for them.
Yeah, whenever I get a story on Facebook about anything going on whenever I find a story, I post it to Facebook mm-hmm. and I claim this is supreme thuggery. You got people like what's going on in Greece right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's utterly ridiculous what's going on here in this country in terms of Rauner. I mean, all the stuff that we talk about in labor hours.
There's a supreme thug.
How is that not supreme thuggery? You are exploiting somebody for your own purpose.
For your own profit
and for the profit of others.
You're
hurting them in the process. People are dying. We are at a human rights crisis, not just in this country, but across the globe.
Yes.
And that's what supreme thuggery is doing to us, and it's been doing it for decades now.
Okay.
Well, you know what, though? I mean, Rauner, I don't agree with all the things that he does or says, but I do feel like there should be a limit where, okay, say, if you can work, why come you're not working? Okay, so now they're paying for you when you can go out and do these things yourself.
But we have to remember that there are no – that's the thing, though. You have so many barriers to why people aren't working. There is probably a very small percentage of the working poor who literally don't work because they don't want to. It's a very few. It's like that labor participation rate I talked about earlier. There are people that are so disillusioned that have been looking for work. And these are people that I know and I've encountered. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of people in this country who have not found a job to where their unemployment benefits have ran out. And they still can't find work. They put in application after application after application. But the problem is that their jobs are disappearing and that they may have some type of thing on there. Like they have a felony on their record or something like that. I mean, it's so many barriers to employment to where people are just there are some people that give up and say,
they just, like what people say,
they forgot about me. Why should I have to go out and try to find a job when I've been looking for one for years? Some people have been looking for a job for like 1-2 years.
Some employers basically won't hire people because they have bad credit.
The new credit check.
Not to mention, you're never arrested. The other thing, too, is like, if there are some people like that, how much are they going to get paid? You know, I mean, I knew a woman, my wife and I, we were first married. I was a single woman who had three kids that lived next door to us. And she wanted to, she was on public assistance, and she wanted to get off public assistance because she wanted, she was like in her like mid 20s, and she wanted to start a career, get some education and stuff. And, but when she started adding up the numbers about, okay, if I go get that job for, you know, it pays a little more minimum wage, you know, it's a start. But then when I'll have to give up my, I'll have to pay for daycare. I'll have to give up my food stamps, and more importantly, I'll lose my medical card for myself and my three kids. She says, I'll be worse off.
Yeah.
I'll be a lot worse off, actually, you know?
And that's the way it works in this system, is that if they can prove that you make a certain amount, if you make $20 over the legal limit for welfare, you're done. You're out of luck. There's nothing you can do. And that's something that has been a historical problem for all, especially African-American people, is that they find that ceiling that you you can really consider it a floor, to be honest, because it's so low. But they find that place, and so many people are right above it that they can't get those types of benefits. And then when something happens to them, I mean, like I said, I can't equate it to anything other than a human rights crisis at this point.
And let's not forget, I mean, the majority of people on public assistance of one form or another are not African American.
No, they're not.
I mean, it's actually white people, European people, So I mean, and I'm not belittling them for needing it, and everything. It's just, but the myths, you know the propaganda. Right. It's all mostly black people that are on public assistance. It's really? Look at the statistics. Look at the numbers.
But the one thing that they hold is that they don't have that basis of racial oppression, and that if there's certain things that can happen for them that can't happen for African Americans because of the color of their skin and because of the ideologies and policies that are in place in this country. That's the thing. So
it's a vicious circle that they've created, that we have to try to figure out ways to this is an interesting show to be having on 4th of July. I mean, this is like the nation's birthday, right, and everything. And we could do a whole show about, the myths, and the reality, if you will. But, one thing that good that did come out of the American Revolution was the Bill of Rights. And that was a struggle. And if you think about 200-some years ago, that at that time, when you look at, in its historical context, in other words, at that point, it was something that was pretty progressive at that time. Now we all know too, unfortunately,
they've never actually been in effect, because like right afterwards was something like the Alien Sedition Acts and all these other measures to curtail the Bill of Rights and freedom of speech stuff. But like you said, it was a very progressive measure though at that time when they were written.
And you look at real history here. What gives me hope? I get really depressed. That's like, good Lord, what is anything? I mean, this is just getting worse. And I mean, I'm going to be 58 years old here in 3 weeks. And it's just like, man, when I graduated high school in 1975, oh man. And it looked like we were heading in a great direction. The revolution was on its way here. We got rid of Richard Nixon. We ended the Vietnam War. Jimmy Carter got elected and was talking about legalizing marijuana, put solar panels on the White House, was starting to talk about that the U.S. foreign policy should be based on human rights. And, of course, he got viciously attacked. Okay. And then the empire struck back in 1980. Well, they started organizing before that. The Powell Memo came out in 71. The Christian fundamentalists started running and winning school board elections and city councils. The business roundtable formed and went after the construction trades. And they basically, there was a lot of stuff going on in the 70s, they were building on. And then come 1980, when Ronald Reagan was, elected, it's been downhill ever since.
I mean, it was a strict response to so many gains, like you said, made by workers.
In the 60s and in the early 70s.
Because a lot of people don't know mid-70s. About that history, but globally, workers were making a huge progressive movement from the mid-60s to about 72, 73.
Yep.
That was a major turning point, and a lot of people invoked these neoliberal theorists to actually come in and work with their governments in Europe and in the United States. They actually hired these professors and these scholars who specialize in the neoliberalization process.
Try to reverse that.
Yeah, to guide them. Yeah.
Milton Friedman.
That was an emergency response. Reagan, Thatcher, and all of these conservative right-wing politics and neoliberalism, they were really scared that there was going want to be that revolution happening, because there was so much gain in such a small amount of time from the 60s to the 70s. So, yeah.
But what gives me hope, you know, even though it's been downhill since 1980, regardless if we have a Republican in office president or the majority in Congress or a Democrat, it's like it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. The same corporate agenda is being pushed and pushed and pushed. Working people are getting worse off. Their standard of living's falling. I mean, our standard of living, I remember back in, when I went to Germany in the late 70s, it was pretty comparable standard of living between here and there. But, man, by the late 1980s, I mean, Europe surged ahead of us for a while. You know, I'd come back and talk about what, German and other European workers had. Free health care, free daycare, free college education. Mother and father both got 6 months paid maternity leave, full 100% pay, 6 week paid vacations. I'm probably forgetting some things here, but they pay a little higher taxes, but you think about the savings just on the health, care alone, but what gives me hope, Gus, even though I'm so depressed about this, trend, is that throughout the history of the U.S., people have always eventually started fighting back and winning, so we're winning. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Well, it's Iman again. Since Gus brought up the Alien and Sedition Act, that was done by John Adams, the second president of the United States, because after there were a lot of people fleeing France to come here because of the oppression in France. And they weren't getting their rights. The French were second class citizenship. So, and there was an attempted revolt by the French. And that's why the Alien and Sedition Act, because they were opposed to U.S. policy. Anyway, I'll let it go at that.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay, let's see here.
All right, so we're back. Yeah.
But, yeah, if you don't mind, though, somebody basically hit me up a minute ago on Facebook about this idea about the Amazing Grace song.
Yeah.
So it's kind of up for debate because just according to the research that the person found that sent me this, Amazing Grace, if I can read some of this, the hymn was quite popular among both sides in the American Civil War. While on the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee were not always able to give their dead a full burial. Instead, the singing of Amazing Grace had to suffice. Since then, Amazing Grace is often considered the Cherokee national anthem, and for this reason, many contemporary Native American musicians have recorded this song. It has also become known as a favorite with supporters of freedom and human rights, both Christian and non-Christian, as is believed. So, what the research is saying, and again, this is still up for debate because this is an internet source, but that it's not, we don't know if it technically was the song for the for lynch mobs specifically,
or for the slave traders soothed the slaves overboard.
So it has a very complicated history, and so just wanted to put that out there for readers and to kind of do some more research on that. So
okay, all right, let's see, is there, we got a couple more minutes, Angela, some more things on your mind today? Are you going to go out and have, you got your, somebody special is going to take you out for dinner tonight? Or make you dinner?
Going to barbecue at home.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, oh, great.
What time? Just kidding.
When I leave here.
Okay.
So, and then, I got to see the fireworks. I literally get excited off fireworks.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, that makes me know that my birthday is here.
Oh, okay, all right.
There you go.
So,
I love fireworks.
Do you have hope, for the future, for all of us? I mean, do you think are going to happen for the better here eventually?
Yes.
I think, Gus, I was talking to my friend out in Oakland about this. It says, gosh, does it have to get, it seems like in history, it seems like things have to get really, really bad before good things finally start changing. And it's like, why does it have to be that way?
Because that's the human condition. And that's why, Frederick Douglass, Karl Marx, Lenin, that's what they've all said it, that the worst conditions and the worst oppression always has a dialectical relationship to the best democracy and the best resistance. That's just who we are as humans. And that's what collectivizes, because to do the things that have to be done to overturn oppression, you have to be taken to an extreme point, because we're talking about full-scale revolution.
Yeah.
And to do those things and to accept those possibilities and those realms that could take you to places that you're not ready to be taken to, you have to be put in that situation, you know. Yes. And
yeah. And when we talk revolution, we don't mean violence. I mean, you know, the thing is, revolution is just the real definition is a complete change, you know, not little sort of cosmetic little, you know, band-aids here and there, or smoothing out some of the rough corners. Reforms, yes. We're talking about a total change, a total new set of priorities, and that's what this country definitely needs, I think, and that's kind of what I would like to send out there as a 4th of July message. Because remember, the founders, even though I know the talk wasn't always in practice, but isn't there something in the, you know, the original revolution that said the statement, I can't remember who did it, but basically when the people find these, you know, these values that are not, you know, longer serving their interests, that they need to change the, you know, the government, even by force if necessary.
Man, it's in the, I think it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's in the Declaration.